Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is pensions expert Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, we talk safety and risk. For UK savers 10 years on from the financial crisis, are you ready to trust a coterie of banks you've never heard of to get a slightly better rate of return? And where do we go if something goes wrong? Also, where some see misfortune, others see opportunity. How brave investors could be quids in now. But buy low and sell high is not for the faint-hearted. So Simon gives us some tips for holding our nerve and identifying opportunities. Also today, despite IT fails and hacking risks, banks continue to push us online as more and more branches disappear from the high street. Has NatWest come up with a good compromise? How much can you put into a pension tax-free over your lifetime? And are more of us driving around in risky cars? All that and plenty more coming up. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, forget Lehman Brothers. Well, don't, but for UK savers, iSave is the name that will send the greatest chill down their collective spines. If you remember, on Tuesday, October the 7th, 2008, Icelandic bank Landsbanki, which ran iSave, collapsed and it left more than 200,000 British savers fearing for their cash. Now, 10 years on, those scars still remain, not helped by an environment of low interest rates. If you want to get a good rate of return, though, you're going to have to think outside the box. But are you ready yet to trust banks you've never heard of? With noises about another financial crisis looming, will your money be safe? And if they aren't British, where do you turn if something goes wrong? A warm welcome to you both. Simon, what did I save? What happened?
If you cast your mind back those many years to when you could get a decent savings rate, the Icelandic banks were offering exceptionally good savings rates.
Like?
6% plus. Whew. I know, sounds crazy nowadays, doesn't it? Now, the Icelandic banking system had expanded at an extremely rapid pace to become much bigger than Iceland's economy itself. And as part of that expansion, they had launched maybe a year, 2 years before, a decade ago, into the UK market with some eye-catching accounts. And in order to attract savers' cash, they were offering rates that beat pretty much everything else on the market. And one of these accounts or banks that was launched into the UK was branded iSave. And iSave really took the market by storm. Lots of people rushed to put their money into iSave. And you have to think back to these days in the sense that you have to remember what people were thinking back then. And what they were thinking back then was not what we're thinking now in terms of protecting your money. The whole, my bank might go bust, I need to stay under the savings compensation limit. So when Northern Rock rolled around, that was a complete surprise to people. People just never expected their bank to go bust. They didn't expect there to be a run on the bank. They didn't expect to not be able to get
stuff
their money.
It's history and movies, isn't it?
They didn't expect that they were going to have to stay below this compensation limit. A year later, when iSave went under, people were more aware of this, nowhere near as aware of it as they are today. And in fact, I would say that it was iSave that actually made people properly aware of it, because the government had stepped in to help the Northern Rock savers. The issue with iSave was that it was not covered under the UK compensation scheme. You were covered under the Icelandic compensation scheme. And there was a question of, was the government going to step in? Because it didn't have to. And there were lots of people who suddenly discovered that they had large sums of money in iSave that were locked up. Now, there will have been many customers who had a few thousand pounds. There will have been quite a few more customers who had £5,000, £10,000. But there was also a sizable number of customers who had tens of thousands of pounds, maybe even £100,000 in there. A lot of this is to do with the fact that the one thing we discovered through the banking crisis was that there are a lot more people with a lot more money in savings than you think. Some of that is to do with people who have built up their lifetime savings over many, many years. And some of it is also to do with people taking tax-free pension lump sums, which was a much more common phenomenon in those days than it is now. Still, most people do it now, but in those days, you didn't have the pension freedom rules that you have now that allow you to keep your pension invested. You had to take an annuity, and when people took that annuity, they generally took 25% tax-free. If they're a final salary pensioner, they normally took the 25% tax-free, and then they put it in the place where they could earn the most interest on it. And at that time, that was iSave. And so there was a massive collective holding of breath as iSave went down and nobody could get into their accounts. And I have first-hand experience of this. My mum and dad had money in iSave. Again, it was from my dad's tax-free pension lump sum. And there was this big question mark hanging over.
And what happened
to
those savers?
Well, in the end, the government stepped in and then it went after Iceland for the money.
But the reality is you can't guarantee that should something happen.
No, you can't. And actually, the world has changed. And as far as the governments and the banking system are concerned, they have spent the last decade banging on at great length about the Financial Services Compensation Scheme and why you should stay under the limit. There are new rules about bank bail-ins, which means that savers above that level could find their money taken from them. This has happened in other countries. And so I would be very wary about having more than that £85,000 limit with any bank.
What about banks that aren't registered here in the UK? So we have a compensation scheme that Simon's just outlined there, but what about, and I mentioned the coterie of banks, there are a number of these banks and they seem to be the ones that are offering the best rates, not necessarily the ones abroad, but there are some of them abroad. Who are they? Should we trust them? Can we trust them?
Well, it's a bit of a murky world, the old savings market, because there's lots of names that you might recognise, Lloyds, Halifax, Nationwide Building Society. Then there's offshoots of existing banks that you might know or you might not know. I mean, do you know Birmingham Midshires? Do you know who owns that? Intelligent Finance. Then you have the foreign banks that are operating here, trying to pick up money from British savers. You've got ICICI, in fact, it's Indian. Allied Irish Bank, I think that's obvious where that comes from. First Save from the First Bank of Nigeria. Al Rayan Bank. Now, all of those are 100% protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme in this country. But there are other banks that operate under a passporting system with the European Economic Area, which means you need to claim from their home compensation scheme if they got into trouble.
Goodness.
Now, in theory, you should be fine dealing with any bank within the EEA. But these include Agri Bank from Malta, which always makes me think of Angry Bank. Ikano from Sweden, that's actually connected to IKEA. Fidor from Germany. RCI from France, that's Renault's savings arms, as in the car company. Mm-hmm. And Triodos from the Netherlands. Now, all EU countries operate a €100,000 limit, so you'll have to work back on the exchange rate for that. So it becomes a bit confusing, but the answer is stick below £85,000 per individually licensed bank in a single name, and you can double that up as a couple in a joint account. And as long as you do that, you should be safe, because the Financial Services Compensation Scheme acts as the backstop. And if the financials... So the Financial Services Compensation Scheme is a funded scheme, and it could theoretically run out of money.
Right.
But if it did theoretically run out of money, then the government should theoretically stand behind it. But if you're over that limit, then all bets are off.
But it's interesting, you were mentioning there that some banks are offshoots of other banks or offshoots of, you know, owned by this person. And it's well worth remembering that actually if you put 85,000 in one and 85,000 in the other, that extra,
So we're talking about this because our columnist, Tony Hazel, who writes the Prudent Investor column, was talking about savings compensation this week in it and how safe is your banks, because he was reflecting on 10 years ago and everybody's reflecting on the Lehman Brothers stuff 10 years ago. But the thing that really hit British savers was actually the British banks, and it was the savings, not the investments. But we updated our savings compensation guide today, which was information this week, which is information from the FCA, shows which banks are licensed by which, what they fall under.
Great.
If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/savings-compensation, you will find that full list.
Fantastic. Tanya, Simon mentioned earlier about sort of psychology, the psychological aspect of, you know, before the financial crisis, people were thinking in a very different mindset, weren't they? How has that changed, particularly with what Simon said, and, you know, your pensions expert, with taking money out of pensions, putting it into certain areas? Have we become riskier because of an environment of low interest rates? Have we become more safety conscious?
I think people have become more wary. My mum asks me all the time about these licences and can she open a bank account here or there. I think people, like Simon said, had absolutely no idea what was coming. And since then, the memory of a bank run, the memory of the queues outside banks has really stayed with people. I think there were some really chilling moments in that whole debacle as well, that the chill hand still descends on your shoulder when you think about it. Alistair Darling recounts how he was literally getting calls from high street banks saying there's only a few hours before we have to shut the cash machines, or words to that effect. I mean, it really concentrates your mind when you hear things like that about what they actually went through at the time and how serious it was. And I don't think we've recovered from it at all.
I just think about a whole generation of people growing up in that sort of environment now.
Yes.
Making those financial decisions, what impact will that have? Simon, they say that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But I wonder how foolish, and you've written about this, were those who invested in the stock market at the height of the financial crisis when others were literally running scared. I mean, Tanya's just given an example of just how scary that time was. Now, the FTSE had already dropped 20% when Lehman's filed for bankruptcy. It fell further than that. But brave investors who ploughed their money into the stock market would be up 137%, according to some number crunching that you've got here. Now, and at the absolute bottom, and if you're unlikely to have done that deliberately, you'd have made a 290.5% return. Now, just to compare that with cash, if you'd have played it safe there, we're talking 17% up. But with Gordon Brown et al. Warning of a bigger, badder crash on the horizon, is this a trick that will work a second time round? Could you be brave enough? Simon, you've written about this, but firstly, we do always say, don't we, buy low, sell high. So to buy in the stock market when it's falling seems to stick with what is conventional wisdom, right? However, give us a context of why, at that moment, back in 2007-08, and Tanya, as I said, touched on it, that may not be the case. You know, this was a very unique set of circumstances and people may be a little bit more cautious.
Yes, indeed. So, be greedy when others are fearful. That's the advice. That's a Warren Buffettism. The problem is that when everybody's panicking, it's very difficult to be greedy. I wrote my column about this last week and we had some figures about it this week. If you cast your mind back to when Lehman went under, the stock market, as we said, had already been falling for almost a year. It was down about 20% in this country. The global market was down about 25%. It's very difficult to think about investing when the market is down 20%. Ideally, you should always keep some cash, particularly when the market's been rising for a long time, as it has been now. You should always keep, if you're an investor, you should always keep some cash around, because when the market falls 20% or 30%, you should buy. Now, it might keep falling, but if it's fallen 20% or 30%, at some point in the future, you're probably going to make a healthy profit. And in order to be able to buy, you're going to need some cash, because if you've got all your money tied up in investments, they will have all fallen in value. But we just had a conversation about the banks and savers and people's savings being locked up and queues for the cash machine and people worrying that you're going to work and you think, could Lloyds actually go bust today? Could Halifax actually go bust today? Could Barclays actually go bust today? At that point, there weren't many people thinking about buying up large chunks of the stock market and piling in. And in fact, even if they had have done, there's every chance that over the next 3 to 4 months, they might have panicked and pulled their money out because the stock market had about another 20% to fall. And so as things intensified after Lehman and everyone really did start worrying that the global financial system might fall apart, which is what the concern was at the time, and people were talking about, should we be doing these bailouts? But if we don't do these bailouts and we don't save the banks, could the entire social order of the developed world collapse? It was a bit tin hat time. So buying in was a tough decision to make. But if you had have done, you'd have done very well. If you'd have bought in at the point of Lehman, the market still had further to fall. You'd be up 137% now. If you'd have bought in at the start of 2007, before the credit crunch arrived, before the financial crisis arrived, before the stock market peaked, but close to that stock market peak, you'd be up 100%, you'd have doubled your money. And obviously, as you said, if you'd have bought him at the bottom, which is very unlikely, yeah. you'd have managed to do that, you'd be up 295%. If you'd bought in on the 1st of January 2009, before the bottom happened, you'd be up 209%. So those are big numbers, particularly when you compare them to that cash figure. I think that cash figure is underplayed because they have used the Bank of England base rate as the return. And if you are a savvy saver, you will not be earning the Bank of England base rate on your savings. You will be earning a considerably more than that. Even today, with savings rates that are rubbish, you can get about 1.3% on a decent instant access account, whereas the Bank of England base rate is 0.75%. So, but if you've got legacy savings that you've just left sat there and you've got inertia kicking in and you're not doing anything about it, then you could be. But it does show that if you're willing to take a risk and think long term, i.e. not a year ahead, not 2 years ahead, and you buy in and you reinvest the dividends, then you can make money. The problem is people also look at just the index number and not the total return. So the total return is what you get from the dividends as well as the rise in the share price index. And it's actually the dividends and the compounding of dividends over the years that delivers most investment returns. But they think back to the fact that the FTSE peaked on December the 31st, 1999, before the dot-com bust, and it didn't manage to regain that level for 15 years, I think it was. So as far as they're concerned, that was a lost 15 years. But actually, if you'd taken the dividends and reinvested them, you'd have been back above the peak well before that.
But why is it so resilient? It seems to me that, you know, whatever's happening at the moment, it's like, yeah, whatever. Stock market's just going Trump, whatever. You know, Brexit, whatever, now. I mean, is anything going to topple this? She says,
well, there's meant to be these characteristics of a stock market boom and bust. And the final one is euphoria. And you get this, yeah. you have this idea of the melt up. So there's euphoria where everybody just buys. Prices just keep going up and up and up and up and up. Now, arguably, we have not seen euphoria yet. The question is, will the melt up happen? And if you invested now, would you make enough money from the melt up and managed to get out early enough in the crash that you wouldn't then just lose all the money you'd made in the melt-up? And would you even get out, or would you just hold on? You start to talk about market timing there, and that becomes a very difficult thing. I mean, if you want evidence of what a melt-up looks like and what a euphoric stage looks like, look at Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in the run-up to Christmas and the tail end of last year. We watched it happen, unfold in front of us, one of the most stupendous bubbles we've seen. If you're a long-term investor, really, you just want to be investing money over a long period of time into decent assets, reinvesting your dividends, try not to buy stuff that's expensive, try to buy stuff that's cheaper, be a bit choosy about where you are, diversify so you're not just buying one tiny part of the market, which is why those people who just bought the FTSE 100, it took them so long to get back, whereas if they bought into the global stock market, they'd have been well above that level long before. Do all those things sensibly, and investing in the stock market has proved to be, over a very long period of time, the best chance of delivering inflation-beating returns. But it's because companies have the power to take money and turn it into profits.
But the reality is there are opportunities in these dark times. And what's interesting, you've been looking at the funds which have done the best since Lehman's collapse. Winner is up 720%. A bit of a surprise.
No one would have guessed that a Japan fund would be the big winner.
Why? Why would they not guess that?
Japan hadn't been doing very well for a really long, long time. It had had a, you know, terrible crash. It hadn't recovered from it. And if you were looking at all the investments that you could possibly get into at the height of the financial crisis, you wouldn't pick out Japan. The other ones that did well were tech, biotech and small companies. Those are the sectors. I'd argue that nobody would have seen any of those. The trouble is that none of those four areas will probably be the ones that in 10 years' time we are sitting here saying, oh, who could have seen those coming? Those won't be the ones. It'll be a completely different lot.
Which is interesting, because I would have said exactly those sorts of, you know, the tech, the biotech and the small companies would have been the ones that, but then you never know, right?
You never know.
Is there any idea that of what investors are telling you both about the areas that perhaps they're excited about, perhaps they're more worried about? And by the way, this is not financial advice. It's just what you guys have been hearing from the investors who are, you know, putting people's money in certain places.
Stuff that isn't expensive is what I hear a lot of. And, I mean, obviously I'm biased towards that because I happen to think that that's a good outlook for investing. So things that aren't growth companies, everybody's been chasing up the growth stocks, the
growth.
Amazons, Googles, the FANG companies, the companies that are perceived to have this potential for exponential growth. And so you're buying future growth. You're paying a very large multiple of the price in terms of the share price versus the earnings, because you're buying into the idea not only will that growth occur, but it will just keep coming and coming and coming. Mm-hmm. The problem is that leaves a great opportunity for disappointment when that growth slows down. We've got an issue where, for example, the social media companies are going to find themselves much more tightly regulated, and it's going to become harder for them to make profits. They can still make very good profits, and Facebook makes an awful lot of money, but it's going to be harder for Facebook to make profits in the future. Whereas if you look at a company that has been beaten down because people just, their sentiment against it is negative, they don't like that area, but actually that company turns out to have a decent balance sheet, it's not got lots of debt, it's trading at a low price to earnings multiple, I would think that that is a better opportunity, because you've got more headroom for people to think, oh, actually, you know what, that company does some quite good stuff, so that money I'm going to take out of Facebook, because I don't think Facebook's going to keep growing at this pace, I'm going to put into that company. But the key, I would say, for people who are buying individual shares is debt. Watch out for debt. Don't buy overly indebted companies. Every single high street failure that we have seen so far this year has all been because of debt. Because when their sales start falling or their costs go up, they've got to keep meeting the debt repayments, and then they have a problem. In terms of areas, I interviewed Mark Mobius the other day, who's a very famous fund manager, deals in emerging markets. He still believes that emerging markets are the best place to invest for the next 5, 10, 20 years. But he said, but I would think that. I'm biased. I'm an emerging markets fund manager. But he says they're cheap. Sentiment is negative. People don't like them at the moment. People are really worried about, they see headlines about Turkey, Argentina. So I think they're an opportunity. Frontier markets, very for the brave, you're going to get a roller coaster ride. But these are the places that are coming up behind the emerging markets, and people are worried about them because they see them as risky, which means that, again, they can be cheap. And there's a place closer to home that people really don't like as well. The UK. Investors don't like the
Wales?
UK at the moment.
What are we talking about here?
Yeah, Milton Keynes. Yeah. Actually, no, Milton Keynes, people love
like Wales.
Milton Keynes
way.
Is well on the up. It's the UK. People, for obvious reasons, they worry about the UK, they worry about Brexit, they worry about our consumer economy. Things aren't going that bad. If we get a deal, which looks slightly unlikely at the moment, but if we get a deal, you might get a bit of an upswing. But even putting Brexit to one side, there's lots of really good companies in the UK with strong balance sheets that pay reasonable dividends, especially in the smaller and mid-cap section of the market, and that do great things and do business all around the world. And even if the worst kinds of Brexit happens, they're still going to be really good companies that do really good things and don't have lots of debt.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, moving on from there, if we needed it, we got another couple of reminders of the risks this week of a cashless, bank branchless society. Now, customers of RBS, NatWest and Ulster Bank had trouble accessing their accounts through the banking group's online and app platforms. Now, this echoes problems that customers at Barclays had been having earlier in the week. But for those wanting some human contact when it comes to their finances, perhaps it's to talk about an issue like this or something else, the opportunities are becoming increasingly limited. Well, NatWest have a plan to breach that gap with a group of community bankers. So I spoke to one of them, Rachel Williams, at the NatWest Bangor branch.
So I'm one of 89 community bankers, and we work sort of quite closely. In March 2017, the role was officially launched, and we did it because we can see a trend and a pattern and a difference in the ways that customers are choosing to do their banking with us. More people are wanting to do the online and telephone, you know, mobile banking with us. We also understand that there are people who still prefer that face-to-face contact. So we offer things like home visits. We can meet up with customers in their workplace. We can offer free financial health checks, coach people in terms of if they want to use the online and app and they're not comfortable. And we are also educating customers as well, whether that be through delivering a scam awareness session, a digital safety session, or a waste to bank presentation. And we're also getting involved in a lot of the local schools as well, delivering money sense sessions. So it's all about helping our customers and finding ways to make their banking and their lives a lot more convenient than we have previously. For example, we've got a customer that I've helped. She's a mum of three and she really struggles to get into the bank. So by me having the time to go out and visit her in her workplace on her lunch, we were able to sort of look over her finances, conduct a free financial health check and look at the ways that we could make her banking more convenient. We downloaded the app, we did the online banking, and you know, I really love that flexibility that we've got around this role. So a typical day in the life of a community banker, we will hold a drop-in session in each location that we cover on a weekly basis. So that would be in somewhere like a local library, leisure centre, that type of place. It will be a set day and a set time just to make sure that customers know where they can get us if they just want to drop in. And we will also arrange to meet people, as I say, to conduct appointments at a time and place that suits them. And that can be a workplace, home visits, if people are struggling to get out and about. Everything we do is absolutely free. So yeah, whether they choose to be with a community banker, use our telephony service, the online platform, mobile app, and all of the events that we run as well, they're open to all of the public. And we quite often go into local workplaces to deliver those, or local groups such as perhaps maybe an over 50s club, Rotary Club. The community banker is in a way sometimes a lot closer than what their local branch will have been. And the fact that we're going to them at a time and place that suits them, that, you know, it minimises the amount of travel, parking, that type of thing. I'm really excited about the future of banking with all of the new platforms that we're introducing, and we're constantly monitoring and introducing new ways and more convenient ways for customers to bank with us. I feel like a lot of the work we're doing really is very important, educating and stopping scams and fraud. The feedback we're getting is absolutely great.
That was Rachel Williams there. So, Tanya, before we get into what perhaps we make of the idea of community bankers, we're hearing all the time, aren't we now, of problems with online banking, and yet we are being pushed further and further down that road, aren't we?
Yes.
And I've asked on this show so many times, is it a matter of being ready for it? Are they moving too quickly? Is this a glitch in the system that we're forever going to have problems, IT failures, hacking issues, et cetera, because that's inbred in the tech? I mean, what is this?
I think it is relentless, and I think they are pushing it too fast. All these meltdowns just prove it. But also, I don't think people are ready to give up branches. There's lots and lots of people who want personal service. They want to be sure that they're dealing with their bank. They're so worried about scams. The only way they can be sure that they're dealing with the right person is to go into the bank. They don't even want to phone up in case they phone the wrong number given them by somebody who's dodgy.
With that in mind, in an environment of trust that we've just been talking about in financial institutions, is there something to be said? And I wonder, because we've seen Metro do rather well on the back of this idea of, you know, having some branches, God
yes,
forbid.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether there is something about visually seeing, touching, feeling bricks and mortar.
You know who you're dealing with.
Yeah.
You know you're dealing with a representative of that bank. And that being certain of that is really important to a lot of people. We say older people, but I don't think of myself as an older person, but I actually really like personal service. I don't use those self-service tills. I don't read my own meters. I want people to do this stuff for me. I really like the service ethos, and I don't want to be running around doing what I see as companies own admin for them all the time. So I feel that this move online and away from branches has gone too fast. And I think that people forget that banks are a utility. I think they certainly forget that they're a utility. But we need banks. We absolutely need them to operate in our society. We need bank accounts. When people lose access to it, that's really serious. The government seems to be far too busy with Brexit to look at something like this. But I really question whether there should be more regulation to make sure that banks are providing a basic service to all their customers. And if that includes keeping branches open in small towns, I think that should be part of it. I don't understand why we're not taking a firmer line with them and just leaving it to the free market and letting them decide when they want to close a branch. it's too important to just let them decide, I think.
Interesting views. The cynic would say things like this sort of community banker is just a cheaper way of answering an issue which you've just highlighted there. We can still close bank branches, but look, we've got some other service. I mean, I quite like it. I like the idea of going out, because actually the reality is, when was the last time anyone here went into their bank branch? I mean, I don't... All right.
We're both putting our hands
have gone up. Okay, but... Actually, I need to go into the bank after the show. But look, that's neither here nor there.
I go in about once a week. And do you know
why?
Really? To do various things that I want them to do, which I don't want the hassle of doing myself. Why should I do all this stuff? I want them to do it. I go in. Well, luckily, we have a branch of my bank right next to the office. And often at lunchtimes, I pass it. There's a massive queue. And I think, oh, OK, I'll go tomorrow. So... Actually, even if I only go once a week, I'm practically checking every lunchtime. If there's two people in the queue, I think I'll take my chance and go in and get what I need done.
And the fact there's a queue shows that...
Shows demand.
Yeah.
I went into the bank yesterday.
All right, then, fine.
But I hadn't been in there for a long time since before. Actually, I'd been in the day before. But this is because I basically had some checks I needed to pay in. And the day before I went in, I didn't have them all on me. So I had to go in 2 days in a row. But yesterday I went in, HSBC... Kensington High Street.
Mm.
I mean, it's a fairly, you know, flagship area, old Kensington High Street, for a bank. It's a big building. It's a grand big building. You walk in, you've got a big downstairs area where you've got about six or seven machines. And then you've got a bit where you've got someone standing, not standing guard, but they're standing there waiting to ask people what they want. And then they farm them off to the personal banker kind of people who are there to help people. And then if you want to go to the cashiers, though, you have to walk up a big set of stairs to this tiny little area where there's three or four cashiers' desks, but there's normally only one person actually manning them, and there's normally a big queue. So I'd rather hand my checks over to the cashier. I'd rather encourage the continued use of people to do jobs. However, I walk in...
Mm.
Oh, I can't be bothered to walk up those stairs.
Simon.
And I know when I get to the top, there'll be a massive queue and only one person working. So I get tempted by those machines. Now, yesterday, all of those machines were completely empty. There was, however, a queue of people queuing up to see the gatekeeper, who then decides whether they're allowed to go see someone who actually works for the bank. So I went to fill in my check slip. Unfortunately, someone had ripped the pen off its little chain and stolen it. So I went over to another bit by the gatekeeper, where I fortunately found a pen. Whilst I was doing it, I had the checks laid out and I was filling in the slip. And a man came up to me and said, "Are the machines working, the paying in machines?" I said, "I don't know, mate. I haven't tried to use them yet. I don't work here." He said, "Oh, I just thought you were doing paperwork, so you must work here. You've got all those papers here." I said, "No, I'm about to pay in some checks myself." But this was my banking
authority you have.
It was, yeah. This was my banking experience yesterday. And it's sort of reiterated to me how banks are failing their customers, even in the branches that they do have. Why are the cashiers not downstairs, where you can easily access them when you walk through the door? There are disabled people in this world who might not be able to get up that
exactly
wacky great set of stairs, or old people, for example.
Or you that can't be bothered.
Yeah, or me, who can't be bothered to go check. So then I don't use them. So then they go, but nobody uses the cashiers. Mm. That's because you've hidden the cashiers. There's only ever one of them.
It's true.
And they're a pain to get to, and the machines are closer. But it indicates to me that they're not doing a great job here in terms of serving people in the existing branch. Now, going back to the community banking thing, I think if banks are going to be closing branches, which I understand why they're doing, branches are expensive, especially if they're little used, but they are an essential service, there's two problems. One, they keep just punting it onto the post office. Oh, well, there's a post office. I'm fed up with this post office nonsense. I know that we've turned the post office into a quasi-bank and a last port of banking call. But it should be for posting stuff, as far as I'm concerned.
And then
you
can't
post. You can't
either.
Post stuff nowadays because it's full of people queuing up to do their
and
banking because someone shut the bank.
Lots of.
However,
queues.
If they are going to shut these bank branches, the idea of sending someone out in a kind of banking truck or a community banker to go to a shop in a village one day a week, everybody knows that's the day the person's going to come. So if they need to do their banking and they're not the kind of person who regularly goes to a town or something like that, or get some advice. Then they can go. They can plan ahead, and they can go down there. And it's better than not having anything at all, or just bundling people off to clog up the post office. You're going to see less people who want to go to banks. that trend will only accelerate. And if the banks get their act together on this whole paying in check with a photograph via your mobile phone, you'll knock a load of people off there. But people do still want to go have the face-to-face contact. And so the banks need to come up with a way of doing that. And if they say they can't afford the bricks and mortar spend, then doing things like having community bankers is definitely a good idea.
Tony, I want to just get your views on this, because while you say, yes, we are inevitably not going to want to go to branches, they don't seem sort of fit for purpose as much as they used to be anymore anyway. But I wonder if there's so much emphasis on customer behaviour and technology and AI and all this stuff. But I keep going back to this idea of, are we ready? Is customer behaviour quite as ready or adapted to that kind of online environment as perhaps the banks and fintech companies as well seem to think? We have the issue with Monzo, for example, going to have its millionth account, but they keep having the problem with people don't mind little bits in there. They don't mind it using it as a budgeting tool. But when you get to the big bucks, a lot of money, a lot of trust, we prefer to go to the bigger branches.
I think they're trying to leave us with no choice. If they close all the branches and your only option is to hopefully still, that we'll still be able to ring up, but to use these apps, then we'll just have no choice. I assume that young people are more likely to adopt these kind of things. I personally wouldn't be happy taking a photograph of a cheque and sending it online somewhere, because I'd be worried about the security aspects of that. There seems to be a lot that could go wrong. They'd have to do a lot of convincing to me that that's a good idea. I'm one of those people who still writes cheques because I find it the quickest way to pay bills. It literally takes me 30 seconds to write a cheque to pay a bill, and everything else takes too long. And because I like to have control over when I pay my bills, rather than doing it direct debit, I still do that.
You still get a chequebook? Do you have to ask for it? I've not had a chequebook since like 1963,
I'm sure if you request one, they'd be forced to send you one. If you do get chequebooks, they send you replacement ones every time you get near the end.
There you go. Right, well, don't worry if you don't have a community banker near you or a branch or anything to answer your money questions, because you can just fire an email to Simon and the team and they will do their very best to help you out. Now, this week, Tanya, you have a question. We're going to move on from banking on to pensions. And this is about the lifetime allowance and how it works. So explain, if you would, the issue further. You've got a 75-year-old who got in contact with you.
Somebody wrote a question to our pensions columnist, Steve Webb, about this, asking how the lifetime allowance operates. It's a nice problem to have, because the lifetime allowance, which is the total you can save into a pension tax-free over a lifetime, is £1,030,000.
Why do we even have one at all? You do your best, you try and save into a pension, seems sensible. Why would you stop people saving into it?
Well, there's only a certain amount of tax relief they're prepared to give. It costs the government money. The lifetime allowance has gone up and gone down a lot over the last 10 years. But that is what it currently sits at. The kind of people who are knocking up against that are not short of money. But more and more people are going to be facing this. Investment growth means that it pushes a lot of people nearer and nearer to the limit. Our reader was asking, when am I going to be tested for this? What are the points where the tests kick in and how do they work it out? Steve Webb wrote a really thorough answer. They call them benefit crystallisation events, which is the most horrible jargon ever. But basically, when you take your 25% lump sum, when you buy an annuity, when you start taking tax, any kind of cash out of your pension, and also when you hit 75, which is at the cut-off point where they don't give you pension tax relief anymore after the age of 75, and they test it again then. And he explains in great detail how they work it out. It's done on a percentage basis. Mm-hmm. How much is in your pension and how does that compare to the lifetime limit? And every time they test it, they work it out as a percentage and they add it up. Each time they test it, they add a bit more to it. If you reach 100%, then the penalties can kick in. If you stay under it, then they don't.
Simon, we've spoken about champagne problems last week, didn't we, with inheritance tax. To a certain degree, another such issue. But again, both of these seem to be dragging more and more, I hate using the word, normal people in it.
Yes, and I would suggest that this is not actually such a champagne problem as people might think, because people underestimate the amount of money that they can end up with in a pension if they have a lifetime of saving and end up earning decent
What
wages.
Sort of person putting away how much would end up with that sort of money? I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands a month? Are we talking...
If you saved £400 a month, which is quite a lot of money, but if you consider your contribution, your employer's contribution, and the tax relief that you get on money that goes into your pension, it's not actually that much. Mm. Over 40 years, which is a long time, but if you work from 25 to 65, you've done 40 years, and you get an annual return of 7%, which is ambitious, but, you know, not unfeasible by long-term standards, you will hit £1 million.
Okay.
If you reduce down the annual return, then obviously at 5%, it suddenly becomes much less and you only hit £610,000. That's probably more than most people think. Mm. But then if you reverse that and you actually up the amount of money that's going in, because let's face it, if you have a good job and a decent wage, hopefully your salary is going to go up over time.
Yep.
Your employer's going to put in more. You're going to hopefully get wage inflation as well over the years. You know, that might return.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so if you had £700 a month going into your pension on average over that 40-year period, you'd hit £1 million at a 5% average annual return. You'd hit £1,068,214.11. So that does show that we're not talking only about these people on executive salaries. We're talking about people who are traditionally considered on, you know, the upper middle class kind of salaries, who could quite easily hit that kind of money.
Upper middle class is a good way of putting it as well, because there's a lot of well-paid public servants who fall into that category. There are rumours at the moment that the government might consider cutting the annual allowance, which is how much you can save tax-free into a pension every year. It's currently £40,000. There are rumours and fears that the government might cut that to £30,000. And I'm already getting emails from people saying things like, well, there might be unintended consequences such as senior doctors leaving the NHS. They haven't mentioned head teachers, but that's another one that's obvious. Mm. Why not retire if you can't do anything else with your pension? A lot of people might feel moved to stop work, and it might have, as I say, unintended consequences on really important services that we want to keep going.
And also, I mean, we've said in the past, if you've started late, you might want to be stuffing a heck of a lot more in. I mean,
yes.
30 is ambitious, 40 is ambitious, but still.
And people often put a lot in at the end, especially if they have an inheritance.
Yeah, exactly.
They're often earning the most that they are going to earn at the end of their life. With the annual allowance, you can backdate it, in effect, for 3 years. So you could actually put £160,000 in theory, in 1 year. You have to use up your current year's allowance first. But somebody who comes into an inheritance and wants to do that, a cut to £30,000 would be a significant blow.
And just to put a little bit more context into this,
mm-hmm.
so it's not just multiplying up the numbers, that we're actually talking about salaries. Ideally, you want to be putting 15% of your salary into your pension. Now, that 15% includes the money that you put in, the money that your employer puts in, and the tax relief. If you are earning £40,000 a year, 15% of your salary is £6,000 a year, which works out as £500 a month. If you put £500 a month into your pension over 40 years and you get a 6% return, you will hit £1 million. So that's how people end up doing it. Now, it's highly unlikely that you're going to start on £40,000 a year. Some people will, mm-hmm. but you're going to end up being a pretty high earner by the end of your career if you're a person who starts on £40,000 a year. But maybe you start on 30, maybe you start on 25, but you're not going to end up on 40 either. You might end up on 50 or 60. And remember, you've got 40 years of wage inflation to take into account there. So it's very feasible that over your career, there'll be an average earnings of £40,000, which then working it back from that figure that I just used, you're hitting the £1 million a year. And that's how it happens for people. But people think £1 million, that's so much money, never going to get there.
You might do. All right, our final element of risk, Simon. Would your car pass its MOT? You sure about that? New study claims failure rates have significantly increased since stricter rules for diesel car emissions came in and a host of other changes back in May. So, Simon, just tell us about the changes again. You can listen back to Podcast Pass, but, you know, if you can't be bothered. Simon?
So the MOT was basically completely overhauled. We now have a system of three different ratings. So you have a dangerous defect. That makes the car illegal to drive and it needs to be repaired immediately. There's a little bit of a grey area as to whether you can drive it to another garage to get it fixed. There's a lot of garages telling people that they can't move the car at all, and so therefore they have to have the work done there, and it will cost them X amount having them over the barrel slightly. But dangerous means don't drive the car.
Mm-hmm.
Major fault can still be driven if the car still has a valid MOT, but the defect needs to be rectified before the vehicle is retested. You're not passing your MOT. And then you have the remaining category, which is a minor. That's a bit like the old advisory. Doesn't result in an automatic fault. The issue does need to be fixed at the earliest convenience to the owner, but you can still pass your MOT with it. So, for example, my car recently passed its MOT. First time round, it had nothing wrong with it. I must admit, I was slightly surprised as these new MOT rules had come in. There was just one minor, which was the fact that the petrol cap on it had decided to ping off the car a few weeks earlier, so it had a temporary petrol cap on it, but it managed to pass with that. Now, the thing that's catching people out and why they're failing is to do with emissions, and particularly diesel cars. So 24% more diesel cars are failing, 12% more petrol cars. Basically, the stricter rules on diesel car emissions are it will get a major fault if the MOT tester can see smoke of any colour coming from the exhaust, or finds evidence that the DPF has been tampered with. That is the diesel particulate filter, a part of the car that aims to take out the soot and the bad stuff that diesels pump out. But the problem is they're not ideally suited to cars that only do short town mileages. They need to be refreshed, and the easiest way to refresh them is to take them on a motorway drive of at least half an hour. There's lots of people who just drive around town and they don't do that. So the DPFs don't get refreshed enough. So they get clogged up with soot and then they fail, and then they can be very expensive to replace. So you've had this kind of thing going on where people have had them removed because they might have a mate down the pub who said, oh, I had my DPF removed. You want to have that done to your car, mate, because like going to cost you a couple of grand to fix that.
I don't know what conversations
wrong.
You have in the pub, Simon. But
Or mechanics will have said to people,
well, this is what I was gonna
you can remove that. Probably not your dealer. Not your car dealer's mechanic, but maybe your local mechanic might suggest it. Or some of them just don't work properly and people are driving around with DPFs that aren't working properly. And that's why they are failing their MOTs. And plus with issues with smoke coming out of the exhaust. You know, when you're driving down the motorway, someone puts their foot down and all of a sudden there's this big black cloud that comes out the back of their car. You're failing your MOT if that happens now.
I'm not sorry that people are failing their MOTs over this. They're poisoning us.
You're these quite people, strict about this, aren't you?
Well, I live in a part of London where they test for these kind of things. The emissions are absolutely sky high. My life is probably going to be shortened. If you want to look for a victim of this whole emissions scandal, you're listening to one right now. I just think, OK, so people fail their MOTs and have to get their cars fixed properly and aren't poisoning the rest of us. Good.
Well, there you go. Boom. Thank you very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you agree with Tanya, let us know. Simon, and any other thoughts you might have on the show or anything you want us to investigate.
Email us if you've got a problem you want us to investigate, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. If you want to comment on the podcast, tweet us @thisismoney or come to the site. Read the article that the podcast is published in every week and leave us a comment on there. Join the debate on there or go to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast where you will find all of our podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.